That's it. Boy, I thought everything was the same until I heard about your midweek dinner, that it was kind of light on the pot. But boy, this reminded me of the days long ago. I've been really blessed to be back here. I was thinking before we began tonight that I think it's been like 3 years running, on and off, kind of what you'd call a perforated series or something. And I had about half a dozen folks ask what's going on in my family, what's going on in my life, and I'd really like to just, in a nutshell, just get you caught up real quick if I could. This is the website. If you want to check on the ministry in terms of what's going on there, feel free to do that. If you go to the website, you're going to see there's just the logo is there, and if you there's a hidden link on the logo that if you click on the center of that Celtic cross, it will take you to a photo journal of a two-week ministry I just had in Manila. And it was an amazing time there, teaching in a school for missionary children. 600 kids that were there. They're from 19 countries and 100 different mission organizations had their children there and did some stuff in the inner city there as well. And I'd just love for you to look at some of the pictures. It was a 24-hour flight. My body got back to Birmingham on the 27th, and my soul arrived. It was probably 5 or 6 days later, and they're still trying to connect. They haven't quite found each other. So if I start to stutter or twitch, just come up and slap me real hard, and it'll come back together. But I spent a good time on the plane working on that. No one told me that you can't really fly on international flights because you're somewhere between being too tired to read but too awake to sleep. Had a new grandbaby born in November. Out in California. And I share that with you because it was a real passage for us. I was out there on December 18th. We were visiting. Jill and I were out there visiting our son and daughter-in-law and this new little baby. And I got a call that my mom had passed away. And it was interesting because I had the exact same thing happened in Chicago about 8 years prior with my father. I was down visiting my son, Ben. And so I happened to have the privilege of being with both my sons when I lost my parents. And Jeff just put his arms around me, and I just sobbed, and he held me. And I got done there for a minute, and I looked at him, and I said, Jeff, I said, life is like a river. And I said, there's going to come a day when you're going to be in Benjamin's arms, having received word that I've gone to be with the Lord. And I said, I just am really grateful that we're here together. So, but that's probably the gist of it. So I have four grandchildren now, and I can get in for the senior rate at the movies. So that's been a real blessing. I don't go that often, but it's been a real blessing. We are going to go back to, this is the, if you were here last summer, I think it was last summer. Was it last summer? It was last summer. We were looking at a series about Jesus Christ, and I am excited about this because you are, in a sense, the guinea pigs in that I've not done this material anyplace else before. And what I want to do is pick up where I left off 8 months ago and do another five vignettes on people that whose lives were deeply intersected by Jesus Christ, and what we can learn about him, what we can learn about them, what we can learn about each other. And I want to kind of revisit the rationale I had behind that, because I had said, if you remember this, and some of you were here for that, you probably can remember that I said that Jesus Christ is really the centerpiece of the Bible. Jesus himself said in Luke 24 on two occasions, in verse 27 and then again in verse 44 and 45, Jesus said basically, he says, these are the words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled. And there's another place where it said, beginning with Moses, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures. the things concerning himself. And so Jesus basically even tells us point blank, the Bible, the scriptures are about me. And so he's really the centerpiece of the scriptures. And I mentioned this last time, I just want to skip over this real quickly, but I counted and there's about 40 some specific ministry encounters that Jesus has in the four gospels. And of those 40, there's only 8 people that are mentioned by name. What's the significance of that? That shouldn't surprise us because the gospel accounts are not about people. They're really about Jesus. He's the centerpiece. And so these people end up being kind of mirrors through which we get different perspectives on who Jesus is, who he was at the time. And Paul even goes so far as to say that Jesus himself was his message. He said, him we proclaim, admonishing and teaching everyone in all wisdom that we may present everyone perfect in Christ. And so Jesus said, the scriptures are about me. As we read through the Gospels, we find this kind of unusual absence of the names of people that Jesus connects with. And the one we look at tonight is really amazing because of how long it is and the person has no name. And then Paul says that Jesus is my message. He is who we proclaim. He is what we proclaim. But also we have this idea of a masterpiece. I years ago, when all of us were much younger, I did a series about the potter and the clay. And one of the things I talked about in there was that when a person was studying as an apprentice, there came a point where they got to be a journeyman, and if they were to become a master, they would do a work, and they'd lay it on the table in front of a guild of masters, and if it passed their approval, they were given the title master. And that was called their masterpiece. We still use that word, but it's something that was presented to the guild. And Scripture tells us that we are God's masterpiece. We are going to be presented to him someday. Paul said that this was really his one passion for all believers. There's a neat passage in Galatians 4:19 where Paul uses the metaphor of childbirth and says, I am again in the pains of childbirth until Christ be formed in you. That was his one holy passion in terms of what he was trying to accomplish in the lives of people. He said it was the thing he really wanted for himself as well. Paul says that it is my one hope that either in life or in death, Jesus Christ would be honored in my body. And it's also the thing that God has really ordained for all of us. Romans 8:29, those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the likeness of his son. So this thing of Jesus, the centerpiece of Scripture, he is also what we are to become in the process of growing and transforming into his likeness. It's what God is working in all of our lives. So the more time we can spend looking at him, the better idea we are going to have of what it is that God's trying to make us resemble. That's why we're spending this time on the things that we are. I'm going to use the exact same method that I did last time. I liked it. You seem to appreciate it. And I'm all for innovation, but at my age, if it ain't broke, I'm not going to fix it. So we're going to take a look at the world behind the text. We're going to spend a little bit of time each week trying to dig up some stuff from the past about history and culture, things that might help us have a better understanding of the scriptures. One of the things, as a matter of fact, that's become very important to me, I have a teaching, a class I do on Tuesday nights called Getting the Big Picture on Old Testament Survey. And one of the things that's becoming, every week it becomes more and more apparent to me, is that I have mistakenly read 21st century or 20th century, I've lived two centuries now, down into the scriptures instead of trying to get behind them and understand them from the standpoint of the people who first heard them. And it's been a blessing to be able to do that. We're going to do a little bit of that tonight. The other thing we're going to do, you know me, if you've sat under my teaching, I can't go very far without trying to unpack something in terms of the Greek or Hebrew words because I think they're important. And we're going to take a look at the world of the text, and then we're going to try to bring it home and take a look at what we call the world in front of the text, That's us. What do we do with this information? It's nice to know, but where do we go with this? Okay, and we're going to take a look tonight at the man born blind in John's gospel, and this is the guy that has this famous line, one thing I know. Socrates said that. He said, one thing I know, and that's that I know nothing. This guy said something a little bit more profound, I think. And I want to take some time to look at him, all right? So let's go backwards a little bit. Let's go take a look at some things behind the text. I want to give us a couple things, I think, at the front end that are important. And that's that the we have to remind ourselves that, and this is something that you got to keep kind of slapping yourself and getting refocused because we drift on this. But this story that we're reading, and I'm not going to read the whole thing tonight because it's 41 verses, and I debated it because last time I read the chunks of scripture, but much of the stuff we're using is in here. This story in John chapter 9 was penned probably around 60 years after the event occurred. All right, so John's readers are reading about something that happened more than likely before most of them were born. All right, and there's a couple other things, is that the people that are reading this now are living in a time that's characterized by persecution, by excommunication if you happen to be a Jewish Christian. They were getting kicked out of synagogues a whole lot more frequently around 90 or so. And beloved, there was no temple. You have to remind yourself when you read John's gospel, the people that are reading it are reading stories about Jesus moving and teaching in the temple precincts when they had no recollection of the temple at all. It did not exist. It was gone. It was destroyed in 70 AD by the Roman Emperor Titus, and that was it. And so we have to try to figure, okay, because that's gonna change John's motivation for writing in the first place. All right? We're not reading Matthew, we're not reading Mark, we're not reading Luke that were written before the temple was destroyed, and we're reading after. And so when we look at this story, we have to read it through those lenses. Okay, let's take it in a little bit. There's a pool. This whole story takes place at what's called the Pool of Siloam. This is a 19th century drawing of what they thought this pool looked like. Matter of fact, if you have any books of the Bible, Bible encyclopedias, Bible dictionaries sitting on your shelf, go home tonight and take a look and see what they have for photographs of the Pool of Siloam, because they are outdated as of about 2 years ago. I'll show you in a minute. But this is really an ancient pool. 700 years prior to this miracle taking place, all right? This is the man. Let me just brief you on this because we're not going to read it. This is the story about the man born blind. And Jesus and his disciples are walking along, and his disciples turn to him, and they try to open up this theological can of worms. They say, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? See, in Jewish theology, some people taught that the mother could commit a sin while she had a child growing in her, and it would affect the child. There was even some rabbis that believed that a fetus could sin. And so, matter of fact, there's even a hint in this story. There's a hint in this story that the Pharisees believed that about this man. And you'll see it in a line near the end of the lesson. But this is the one where Jesus mixes the mud with spit, all right? And that probably grosses us out, but there were entire books written on the use of spittle for medicinal purposes at this time, and it was specifically forbidden by rabbinic law for a Jew to mix spit and mud on the Sabbath. I mean, there was a law about that, all right? I mean, they had laws for everything. And so Jesus is really pushing the envelope on this. But this is the one. He sends him to the Pool of Siloam to wash. And he comes back and he's healed. And then all chaos breaks out right after that, right? But this is an amazing pool. It's the King Hezekiah dug a tunnel for 1,780 feet from outside the city of Jerusalem, inside the city of Jerusalem. And this, the amazing thing was that they had two teams of engineers and diggers working from opposite directions. All right, picture this. This is 700 years before Christ. And they met perfectly. Matter of fact, this is right here is what's called the Siloam inscription. It's in Hezekiah's tunnel. If you've ever been to Israel, have any of you been to Israel? Have you ever walked the tunnel? It's supposed to be really cold. I'm hoping to do it in June. But the inscription's inside the tunnel, and it describes the two teams coming together, hearing each other's hammers and chisels and so on. But this is the same place that this is talking about here. It's also Isaiah talks about. Matter of fact, this pool, you guys, is only mentioned three times in the entire scriptures. It's mentioned in John 9. It's mentioned in Isaiah 8:6. It's called the waters of Shiloah, but it's the same thing. And it's in 2 Kings 20, verse 20. But this is a very, very ancient, ancient pool. This has a lot of history associated with it, has a lot of meaning associated with it. It wasn't like the public restroom. Could you go wash your face and then come back and we'll talk? He sent them. As a matter of fact, the name of the pool means sent. So he sent them to sent. But this is an ancient pool. But its exact location was discovered in 2004. And in the scriptures, it's called the Pool of Siloam. And most of the modern drawings of it up until 3 years ago said that, and they'll give you the dimensions of it in the books, it's relatively tiny. The truth is the pool was, they've uncovered it now, 225 feet long. It was a bona fide pool, all right? Matter of fact, here's what it looks like. This is it. Those are the steps. They can't excavate to the right because the garden that's over there is owned by the Greek Orthodox Church, and they don't want them digging over there. Can you imagine? I mean, it's to me, it's almost comical. If you're a contractor, I don't know if there's any contractors in the room, but picture this. You're a contractor, and you're building something, and you come across the set of steps like this. You have to get a hold of the Jewish Antiquity Authority, and they have to come and investigate what you have there, and you may have your whole construction project shut down for 2 years. And that's exactly what happens. Over to the left is a sewer line that they were digging up, and they found they hit these steps, and they went and got people, and all of a sudden they start excavating, and they really are convinced this is it. But it's a sacred pool. It's likely, very likely, that the ritual water that was used for the Feast of Tabernacles was drawn from this pool. If you read in John's Gospel, we're in John chapter 9. In John chapter 7, it talks about the Feast of Tabernacles. And on the eighth day of the Feast of Tabernacles, the priest took a golden pitcher. And they went and they took water out of the pool of Siloam. They brought it into the temple precincts. They poured it on the altar of burnt offering. And they sang from the Psalter. They sang psalms. And so this pool that this man went to had a tremendous sense of religious significance for the Jews. It was what's called a mikveh. A mikveh is a pool that has steps in it, and it was for ceremonial cleansing. If you read in Leviticus and the Levitical law, all the different cleansings that the Jews had to do oftentimes took place in a mikveh, and they believe that that's what this was because of the steps that were there. And it's very, very likely that when Jesus said that he was the living water, do you remember that statement? That occurs right in this context. And very likely he's talking about the same pool. He's talking about the water from the same pool. But it was also what I would call a reflecting pool. I think that the purpose of this story, the reason that John, and I mentioned this last time, let me just mention it again. John's gospel covers about 12 a calendar of about 12 months of Jesus' life. You can picture a calendar on a wall of 12 months, and then you select off that calendar 21 days. That's the Gospel of John. It's 21 days of Jesus' life. Matter of fact, half of the Gospel deals with 3 days of Jesus' life. From John 13 to 21 is from the Last Supper up through the resurrection. And so John was incredibly picky about what he put in his gospel and what he didn't. There's no parables. There's all kinds of stuff that's missing. No mention of the virgin birth, no genealogies, none of that stuff. And so when he puts this story in, it can't just be because he thought it was really a cool story. And he's writing for people that are reading it 60 years later. All right? So what his motivation for writing for them is probably really close to God's motivation for giving us the book in the first place. So I think there's some things to be seen in this pool, that there's a reason for this story. You know, we have to ask ourselves a question. Why do you spend 41 verses of a gospel on a person who doesn't even have his name mentioned? Why would you do that? What would cause John to do that? Who's this story really about? Maybe it's not about the blind man. And who's it really for? That's kind of what we're going to look at for the background. But this is an important piece of Jewish history, this pool. All right, the world of the text, we start looking at some of these words. Blind. Interesting. This is the only instance in the Bible of someone born blind. I counted up all the instances in the entire Bible on blindness, and there's not a lot of them. But it was a big deal to Jesus. There's 62 references to blindness in the Gospels. Almost a quarter of them are in this single story. It's a story that focuses on that. John talks about blindness 17 times. 14 of them are in this story. Now, I'm not an accountant, and I know it's tax season, but I like to do things like this because if you understand that John is the most intentional of the gospel writers, he picked his material very carefully. This is significant. You take his whole gospel, and there's 17 references to blindness. 14 of them are in this story. He packs it all into this story. There's over 30 references to just sight in this account. If you look at words like blindness and seeing and saw and all that, it totals up to 30. This really is a story about blindness. There's something interesting in here, and I think it helps me make sense of a couple things. I don't know if you've read this story recently or if you can recall it from having heard it when you were younger or in Sunday school, but this man, when he gets healed, he gets really upset. Gets really mad. He comes back from the pool having been healed, and it's his neighbors start talking to him. And some are saying, this is the guy that was blind, the beggar, the blind beggar. And others are saying, no, it's not him. And he's going, hello, hello, it's me. It's me. He said, I'm the guy, you know. And I think, and it doesn't say this, but something had to have happened either with his countenance or something. There was enough of a change in his face, I think, from being able to see that some people didn't even recognize him. Now, he may have gotten cleaned up and all that stuff, but I think it was more than that. I think his face had been downcast for years and years and years and years and blank, and now it was full of life. But all of the verbs in here, in verses 8 and 9, there's all these people talking. In the Greek, they're imperfect, which just means they're talking and talking and talking and talking and talking. And finally, he says, I'm the guy. Well, then they call in, the Pharisees ask him to come. And he talks to them. They say, what happened to you? And he tells them, he said, I was blind, now I can see. And then they don't believe him, so they call in his parents. They talk to his parents, and they call him back in. And in these conversations in the Greek, you have to get this picture. There's this tremendous commotion and dialogue. It's going on and on and on and on. And to me, it's almost comical because you got one person that was blind and now he can see. And no one believes him. No one even listens to him. His parents say, well, I'll tell you what, that's our boy. I know that. And we know he was blind. But how in the fat he can see and who done it, we haven't got a clue. You're going to have to ask him. We don't know. And the Pharisees do the same thing. And finally he gets mad. He said, I've told you and I've told you, I've told you. Why won't you believe me? But I want you to see this as this is just an explosion of dialogue and arguing that takes place. Just a tremendous amount, all right? Second thing, and this is a big word to John. John uses the word no 116 times. I mean, that's a lot. That's six times a chapter. There's only 21 chapters in the book. 11 of them are in this story, but they're all the same word. John uses about five different Greek words for no. This story, he doesn't use any other words except he uses the word oida. And it's a perfect tense, all right? You don't have to remember all this stuff. I just want you to understand because it's significant. God gave us his word at a time when he had the most tremendous freedom to say exactly what he wanted to say. And the perfect tense is an action that goes on and stops, but the effect of it goes on and on and on and on. And so you can kind of know and know and know and know, and you stop knowing and you become convinced. So it's a word that means, as close as we can say, certainty, absolute certainty. And the Pharisees claim to know some things. Everybody's telling what they know or don't know in this story. If you look at the word know in here, the parents are saying, I know this, but I don't know this. And the blind man is saying, I know this, but I don't know this. I don't know where he's from. I don't know if he's a sinner. I don't know if he's a prophet. I know this, though. I was blind, and now I can see. And the Pharisees said they were certain of some things. They said they knew the scriptures. Where does it say that? They said, we are disciples of Moses. We are disciples of Moses. That meant that they were conversant and familiar with the writings of Moses. We're following Moses. We know the scriptures. Second thing they said, we know, and they're using the same word, we know that this man is a sinner. He's a sinner. We know it. We are convinced of it. We are certain of it. How do you know that? He doesn't keep the Sabbath. He doesn't keep the Sabbath. And they said they knew that the blind man was a sinner. They said, you were conceived in utter sin, and would you teach us? Now, that's and I'm not going to die for this, and I don't even get beat up for it. But I think it's a possibility that right there, they're blaming him for his blindness. You were conceived in utter sin, and would you teach us? Don't know for sure, but I think they did. They knew the scriptures. They knew that Jesus was a sinner. They knew that the man was a sinner. They seemed to know that everybody was a sinner. Everybody else, that is. All right? The man knew he was blind. I mean, that's kind of infinite grasp of the obvious, isn't it? But I mean, he knew he was blind because he said, I was blind and now I can see. That's what he knew. He didn't know if Jesus was a prophet. He didn't know if Jesus was a sinner. He didn't think Jesus was a sinner, and that got him in trouble. And he didn't know where Jesus was. Jesus healed him and took off. He came back in a little bit. And this man said that he knew that God hears the prayers of those who fear him. He said, we know that God does not listen to sinners, but he listens to those who seek to do his will and who fear him. So everybody in this story knows something and they don't know something. But the Pharisees were certain about some things that were flat out wrong. They were wrong, and they were convinced of it. And beloved, it's possible to be sincerely wrong. I talked with someone this week, and we were talking about different religions and stuff, and they could not get past the idea of sincerity, that these people are so sincere. How could God not accept them? I said, there's an organization in the United States called the Flat Earth Society, and they honestly believe with all their heart that the earth is flat. That's the fact. I mean, I don't know if you know that, but that's a fact. There's a real organization. They have a newsletter. They have meetings. They have officers. They believe that the whole NASA space exploration photography whole thing's a hoax. It's a big government hoax. Now, see, I have real problems with that personally because I was good friends with an astronaut, Jim Irwin, that was in the Apollo 15 crew. He walked on the moon. And my kids were in his daughter's wedding, and I've been in his house. I've seen pictures of the moon. And he's not one brick short of a load, you know. I mean, he was for real. But you can be sincerely wrong. These people were absolutely convinced that Jesus was a sinner, all right? What about bringing this a little bit closer to home? I want to take a little bit different take on this. I want to take a look at what I would consider the real story of what's going on here. I think this is a story about a blind man and a blind mob. I think this is more than a story about a blind man. There are 10 references to the blind man in this passage, you guys, but there's 17 references to the Pharisees. I do not think John put this story in his gospel because he thought it was really a neat, special interest story. This isn't like the first century version of People magazine. I think John put this story in his gospel because, and we'll see here in a second, but I think the stuff he's talking about isn't stuck in the first century. And I really think there's some things in here for you and I in the 21st century. Jesus kind of says there's two kinds of people. This is me talking here, but this is what I distill out from this story. I think he says there's one kind of person that really want to see and keep on seeing. We would be tempted to look at this man that was healed and think he got his sight back, and that's the end of the story. It's not the end of the story. Especially for you and I, it's not the end of the story. There's a second kind of people that Jesus addresses in this story, and I think John is really trying to highlight this, is there's a group of people that think they already see. They already see. The question for us tonight, the question for us tomorrow, the question for us 5 years from now, is which one of these two am I? Which one of these two people am I? Let me show you a couple verses in here. They said that we know that this man is a sinner. Matter of fact, you know, you could probably build a case that this story has something to do with a discussion about sin. And again, I don't want to get stuck on numbers, but 28 times in John's gospel, he uses the word sin, the word, 28 times. 9 of them are in this story. Matter of fact, this story opens in verse 1 with a question, who sinned, this man or his parents? And if you look at verses 40 and 41, it ends with a statement about sin. And if you understand how first century people wrote, sometimes they did a thing, what's called an inclusio, where they'd make an opening comment and a closing comment, and that was kind of we would call it bookending an idea. And it's very possible that this is really about the sin of blindness. Not the sin that causes blindness, that they were asking questions about, physical blindness, but there's a kind of sin that causes a spiritual blindness. And Jesus really goes after that in the last couple of verses. I would encourage you to take a look at this story maybe before the weekend. Question for you and I, when we hear the word sinner, do I think of myself or do I think of others? Because the Pharisees were convinced that Jesus was a sinner. And they missed something very, very big. And that was that they were. Matter of fact, they thought Jesus was a sinner. They thought that the blind man was a sinner. It's very, very clear that he got excommunicated. If you read the passage, it says, I'll show you the verse here in a second, but they threw him out of the synagogue. The verb that's used there, cast out, is the same thing that Jesus did when he turned over the tables and cast out the money changers. It's the same word that's used for Jesus casting out demons. And you know, I don't ever get the picture of Jesus kind of saying, fellas, I really need for you to leave this man. It's just awful what you've been... I mean, I picture Jesus staring right through the person's eyes into the pit of hell and commanding those demons to leave. And it's that same word, what they did with this man. All right. Second scripture, you were born in other sin. And would you teach us? The very next phrase is, and they cast him out. This one, I think, is really a subtle sin of blindness that you and I can fall into, that they had fallen into. What had they concluded was impossible to happen based on what they just said there? What did they think was impossible to happen based on that statement? Yeah, that a sinner could teach them. I mean, these guys were ultra white collar, very rich, very affluent people, highly, highly educated. Knew the Torah inside and out, knew the scriptures inside and out. They were disciples of Moses, and they looked at this guy who was a peasant. All right? If you were a beggar, you were kind of on the level of pond scum in Palestine. You couldn't make a living. The only thing you could do is beg. And he apparently lived with his parents. Sounds like it. Like they dumped him off near the temple every morning and picked him up on the way home from work or something. I don't know what they did. But he was a nobody in the community. And they were really convinced that they could not learn from this person. All right? How about you and I? Who or what will we allow to teach us? If you're an adult, you know, are we open to being taught? I don't mean learning something. I mean God speaking through a high school student in this church or a child. You know, some of the most profound things that God has said to me have come through students when I was teaching high school. In fact, one of my life verses, I mean, a verse that I have clung to, I have wept over, was given to me by a senior girl at Briarwood that graduated in 1997. And I still, that verse is in my pocket. I still carry it around with me. It was profound. I had a girl walk up to me once, not here in Birmingham, because they wouldn't do this in the South. This was back in Colorado. But I had a student walk up to me and said, "Mr. Shaka, your attitude really stunk at the soccer game last night." That's the way they talked in Colorado. They here it would have, there would have been a couple sirs in there, and it would have been kind of padded because they're just a lot more polite. I've come to appreciate that. And she was absolutely right. I was yelling at the refs, and I was awful. And I was a Bible teacher. You know, if you're a man, can God speak to us through our wives? I mean, really. Do you, as a man, do you look for God to talk to you through your wife? Would have done Pilate a whole lot of good to listen to his wife. And there's a verse in Genesis and Peter where Abraham listened to Sarah. God said to Abraham, "Listen to your wife." Who will we allow to teach us? How about an unbeliever? An unbeliever. Speak truth into our lives. You know, God used a talking donkey. Used a burning bush. Used a rooster to communicate something to Peter. These guys believed that this man could not teach them anything. And God was trying to talk to him. Third one. And this is from Matthew's gospel, but it's also from the book of Isaiah. This people's heart has grown dull. Their ears they can barely hear, and their eyes they have closed. And this is maybe the most sobering one for you and I. You know, do you and I believe that we can still become blind? I would love to be able to say that, like the blind man, I was once blind and now I can see. That's kind of the testimony that we like to give. But God would want us to put a comma after that and say, "I was blind and now I can see, but I could become blind again." It's happened over and over to the people of God. David prayed in Psalm 119, verse 18, "Open my eyes that I may behold wonderful things in your law." Paul prayed for the Ephesians, "I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened in order that you may know the hope to which he's called you, the riches of his glorious inheritance in the saints, and his incomparably great power for us who believe." Matter of fact, sometimes the greatest temptation for us who hear so much, and probably more so for me than for you, because my whole life is doing what I'm doing right now, for me to become dull and not hear God speaking to me about me because I'm so concerned about talking to you about him. I can become dull. My eyes can become blind. It's not something that we are exempt from. And so as we bring this to a close, as we looked at this story tonight, I want you to understand, I don't think it's a story about a blind man. I think it's a story about a blind group of people, the same ones that Jesus said, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered you as a hen gathers her chicks under his wings, but you would not." And for us to just be praying daily that God would keep our eyes open, that we wouldn't become dull from being in a Christian setting and listening to teaching and going to church, that we would be open to God talking to us through our children, through our spouses, through an ungodly boss. All right? There was a guy throwing rocks at King David, and he said, "Don't cut his head off. God may have a message for me." That we would be sensitive and listen to God. That's probably the most important thing. When Solomon was, God said, "What do you want?" And the Bible says Solomon said, "Give me wisdom." The Hebrew word there, Solomon said, "Give me a listening heart," is what it means. Help me pay attention. And you know what? He didn't. If you know how Solomon's wife washed out at the end, it was awful. And so for us, just for us, Paul said, "Take heed. Anyone thinks he stands, let him take heed lest he fall." I just think for us to constantly be aware, "Lord, keep my eyes open, keep my heart open. In a sense, keep me bruised so I'm always tender towards you and towards your word." Let me pray. Father, I just thank you so much for this story, Lord, having read it so many times and really thinking it was about a guy and that I was that guy and that I was grateful that I see and I once was blind, and that's certainly true. But Father, I also ask that you keep my eyes open, keep my heart sensitive to your voice. Let me hear you in the quiet places. Let me hear you, Lord, in the obscure places, the unusual places. And Father, let me be sensitive enough to respond. And Lord, help me look at the world around me and understand that, Father, I too am a sinner, saved by grace, but I'm still, Lord, a sinner in this body until Jesus comes back. And that, Father, I wouldn't judge people for being what I am. Thank you for this place. I thank you for the grace that is extended to me each time I come here, and for these folk that come week after week. I ask that, Lord, the people that run into us tomorrow would run into you. I pray for your sake as well as ours. Amen.